Talk Show.
Recorded live.
Hey, Jay. Sorry about the confusion there. I think Talk Show has changed some of their codes, so I didn't know quite what to punch in.
Uh-huh. Right on.
How you doing?
Well, hello. I'm doing all right. How are you doing?
Okay. I'm just getting ready to fix myself a nightcap here. What are you doing there in Missoula, Montana?
I'm having ice cream.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Yeah.
What kind?
Well, it's butter pecan with a bunch of chocolate syrup squirted over it. It's kind of an odd combination, but, you know, it's cold and sweet, so it's good.
Sounds like you are living large.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So
I think I weigh more than I've ever weighed before.
you really are living large. Oh, that's fantastic. Well, that is cool. I am, I've got all this absinthe here, and I thought that I should try to figure out if it can be drunk with anything. So I'm going to try a variety of combinations, and I thought I'd start tonight with a little lemon liqueur.
Lemon liqueur?
Yeah, that's right. So some kind of Italian lemon liqueur. So I'll let you know how it goes. I'm halfway through the preparation here. You kind of called when I was upstairs, and I'm just kind of still getting ready. So bear with me for a moment.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's fine. I'm actually just drinking my old faithful, as it were.
I thought you were having
a bourbon diet. So what's that?
You're fisting at them. Ice cream in one hand and bourbon in the other.
Yeah, exactly. You're kind of your voice is rather fuzzy this evening.
You know, Jay, I've got to confess that I have listened to some of our podcasts in the past, and what I've found is that your voice has a much greater clarity than mine.
Well, it's because I'm so clear-headed.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I suspect that it's has something to do with our cell phones or whatever. I've got a freaking BlackBerry, and those are noted for not being the greatest phones, because they do other things well, but phones apparently are not one of them.
Yeah. Well, if people can't understand the actual words that you say, they can at least appreciate the music of your voice.
Yeah, what about this? Can you hear this?
Yeah, that right. Sounds like you're shaking your something.
I'm mixing my drink, and let me tell you, with the absinthe in with the lemon liqueur, which are, you know, the absinthe is very green, it's a lassé. And the lemon liqueur is very yellow, so this is now a very beautiful, beautiful light green.
Wow. So tell me about this absinthe. This is the real stuff, I assume.
Yeah, you know, it's legal now.
Yeah. Yeah,
so,
I saw some at the store the other day and was going to buy it until I looked down at the price.
Oh, really? Yeah, no, I haven't bought any of these. They've been given to me as a gift.
Ah.
And that is nice. So I have La Fée, which is imported from France. And I've also got another version, or actually, what is it? Obsello, which I think it was Spanish for some reason, but I'm not actually seeing any. Yeah, products of Spain. Mm-hmm.
Wow. So have you been drinking this before?
No, on a very rare basis. I mean, I use it if I'm going to make a Sazerac, but other than that, I've really not indulged fully in the pleasures of the absinthe, because, of course, as you and I have both agreed in the past, the flavor of absinthe is somewhat repellent to our particular palates.
Yeah, it more specifically, it tastes like shit.
To be more specific than that, it tastes like licorice.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, that's not really something I'm looking for in a cocktail. But I've got to say, with the lemon, it's almost tolerable.
Yeah. Well, you know,
first sort of black.
Mushrooms taste like shit too, but you know, there's good reason to eat them, at least on occasion.
Dude, are you shrooming right now?
You know, I'm not actually.
Oh.
I wish.
Oh, that is a nice entree to our topic tonight.
Oh, did we have a topic?
Well, you didn't get the memo.
I got some kind of weird JPEG image on my phone from you, which I could not parse into any kind of recognizable thing other than what looked like a Ziploc bag dangling off your porch or something.
Well, that's exactly what it was. Unfortunately, it was not my porch. It was a restaurant near here, just a few blocks away, actually. But I don't suppose you've seen that. It's actually a big Ziploc bag full of water, which is suspended from the eaves with a penny inside of it.
Has a what inside of it?
A penny, a unit of currency, a 1 cent.
Oh, a penny. Yes, okay. Yeah. Like
yes.
A nickel, except less.
Like a nickel, except a fifth of that, yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's purported to keep the bugs away. And at this local establishment, the Parkway Bakery and Tavern, they have just a whole line of them around the perimeter.
Wow. Does it seem to work?
Sometimes, yeah. Yeah, I've been there sometimes where there's like flies buzzing around. And believe me, when we've got flies here in New Orleans, we've got flies. I mean, they're like it's like a plague that can come down on you to really aggravate. So, yeah, I have been in there where it seems like, well, there's flies buzzing around over there. And we're here on the other side. And the only thing that's keeping them out seems to be these bags. Hanging
that's
up there.
The most ludicrous thing I've ever heard.
It is. It seems very ludicrous, but nonetheless, that I have had that experience. On the other hand, I also have had experiences where we're just being besieged by flies, and those bags don't seem to be doing a damn thing. But there's extenuating circumstances, and we really don't need to get into that because it's taking us far afield.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah. So that wasn't the topic, was the penny bags.
That's not exactly. That's not the topic. So we really need to kind of bend our thoughts back, if you will, to the topic at hand.
Oh, okay.
If you don't mind.
I'm bending, but I feel like I'm bending sort of over a dark abyss because I don't even know what I'm looking at.
Hmm. I love that.
Yeah, I apparently did indeed miss some kind of memo, although, you know, that's not entirely surprising given the sheer volume of mimeographic material I receive every day.
Yes, the mimeographic.
And the Sid-like qualities of my memory, too.
Oh, yeah, well, there is that to consider.
Yeah.
And to contend with. But, of course, what I'm referring to is the state of your spiritual health.
Oh, my. Yeah.
You know, kind of just how are you doing?
Ah. Well, that's a heavy one.
Yeah, well, it certainly is. But, you know, that's where you got to start, I think.
Yeah. Are you asking me, or is this rhetorical? Or
it's not rhetorical. And I am asking you.
Oh, okay. well, then I guess I have to formulate some kind of a quick and sincere answer.
Well, no. Those are not your strong suits. So I would caution you against that.
Okay.
Neither quick nor particularly, sincere.
Okay.
Although we can get around to that in time. Yeah, exactly. Because I feel that that's the only way, really, that we can get around to sincere is through that other path. And certainly quick, quick,
yeah.
That's just not going to happen. So there you have it.
Yeah, cool. Let's see, where to begin? I would say that I find myself in a bit of a transitional state of life, I guess, or not even transitional, because I don't even think that I'm to the point where I want to make a change, but where I am is I'm not satisfied with the job that I have, and I'm not sure whether it's the job or the profession.
Ah.
And so that's sort of been a sort of something hanging over my head lately, and I've tried to avoid it for quite a while. And so you know, part of the reason why it's a hard question to address is because it's only started bugging me enough that I have to acknowledge it lately. So,
fantastic.
And since
you are acknowledging it, though.
Yeah, well, hopefully. You know, so obviously life is not just work. Being somewhat, I think, of a pessimist at heart, sourpuss maybe, I find myself inclined to bring up the points of dissatisfaction, which would be basically that. But surrounding that is a great amount of satisfaction, I would say, about many of the things in life, particularly this child of ours, and, of course, our relationship, mine and Day's. So, you know, that stuff is great. Unfortunately, you know, I have to split time between my life at home and my life at the office.
Well, that is a classic dilemma, of course, one with many, I think, have to wrestle. And it is an unfortunate fact that there is so much alienation between people and their labor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think what you're describing it there is that you'd like a little bit more of a better integration between the spheres, that you wouldn't feel such this dichotomy between, you know, oh, here's the work world over there, and the rest of my life over here, and the rest of my life, pretty cool, but some things about this work life suck.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true, and you know, I think that there are so many aspects to it and ways to turn it around in my head that I tend to get lost on it. And you know, I noticed in on your blog you were talking a couple of times lately about the process of journaling and you know, how you started doing it, and how it changed for
keeper.
You. Say that again?
And you've been a journal keeper over the years, haven't you?
I have in the past, yeah. It's pretty much been something that fell by the wayside several years ago. You know, every once in a blue moon I'll pick up a pen and write some kind of lengthy treatise on why I should... why I'm finally getting back to it, and then usually I don't get back to it again for another 2 or 3 years. But, you know, one of the things that was always useful to me about journaling was that, you know, putting things down on paper, it helped me sort things out a little bit better, because there's, you know, when you got multiple issues or multiple aspects of a single issue that are troubling you, it's hard to sort out how those aspects are interrelate until you put them down on paper and look at them and can analyze them and draw parallels and this and that. I think that would be useful because, I think that the workload at work is really, it just drags on me. So that's one issue.
I don't think it's a lot of writing, right?
Well, it's it's certainly a lot of writing.
And other stuff, I imagine.
And I'm not sure if it's even true that the majority of the job is writing.
Yeah.
You know, a very big portion of it is, and that's certainly the most intensive portion. But, you know, a huge amount of my day is taken up sorting through the 60-some-odd emails that I get from people every day, most of which have some faint relevance. I mean, it used to be that I'd get 60 emails in a day and 59 of them were clearly spam and I could just mass delete them and read the one that mattered. But these days, a lot of, the spam filters are better on my emails, fortunately, so I don't have to deal with that as much. But what I do get is press releases about shows that are happening and bands that are touring through and TV shows that are coming up. And I basically have to at least skim over each one to see if there is a local angle that makes it appropriate to put anything in the newspaper or whether it just is truly, a misguided press release. So email actually takes up a huge amount of my day. And it's just tiresome. So I don't know. I don't feel like I have a lot of specific that I can say about all of this right now. It's been bubbling up lately. I actually, as it would happen, earlier this week, Day and I had a bit of a spat in the morning before we were going to work or I was going to work and she was going to class. And as we were talking through it, it just seemed to come down, at least in large part, the motivation behind it was work stress. Mm-hmm. And then a couple of days or the next day, I think it was, I was walking out of the building with my boss, and she said, how are you doing lately? And I said, doing all right, fine, whatever. And she said she thought I seemed like I was a little stressed out lately. So
yeah.
That's not a good thing.
No, I guess not. Yeah, of course, my wife works in a very high-stress situation, Christy. Teaching in the public schools. She really throws herself into that wholeheartedly, and it's such a dysfunctional system. Even when it works really well, I feel it's almost questionable, but it doesn't even work well here. So that's one of the dichotomies in our relationship here, is that she's got that very stressful work environment, and I have the complete opposite, a very friendly and nurturing and I feel like somewhat empowering job where it's almost, it's on me to try to actually make something of it, and that creates its own stress, I suppose, but it's pretty different from what you guys described.
Yeah, no, it certainly seems that I dare say that either you have even more boundless energy than than I could imagine, which you seem to have plenty as it is, or you have more time to sort of look at the big picture of the world as you're at work. You know, just judging from the types of posts that you make to your blog, I mean, I don't have the energy when it's all said and done after work, or even during work. I don't have the time during work, and I don't have the energy after work to really do much of that.
Well, no, that is a benefit of working, as I do, at a university in a unit that interacts with every academic department.
Mm-hmm.
So I literally have on-the-job calls to contemplate the full realm of human experience there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I talk to people in the theology department. I talk to people in the chemistry department, the art department, English, whatever. I'm able to justify a lot of playing around. In fact, I was saying a while back that playing around is kind of what I do for a living, because I try to play around with all this technology stuff, internet mostly, and then share back what I learn in terms of the new tools that are out there and the different things that are happening in that sphere, the different things that information technology has enabled, and share that back to teachers as, what could you do with it? But in order to see the potential of myself, I have to play around with it a lot as a participant, not just from some kind of distant, academic perspective, but actually as just using it and trying to, enjoy it myself and see what it yields. And so that is, obviously a kind of enjoyable job. I've had the privilege to work with a lot of, just very nice people who are very, it's just a very, I think it's also part and parcel of the academic environment. It's just a little more humane atmosphere to work in, because it's really not driven by the basic business model. Even though you hear a lot these days in academia about, we need to run this thing like a business. It's really not a business. And there's really something at the core of it, which I think is deeply different than the proposition of a business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and, one of the biggest things that I also, that sort of drags down my soul when I think about it, is that, I work for a large corporation that is hardly the worst corporation. I don't really harbor ill will in that regard, but I could, I had a colleague today who just simply didn't show up and didn't call in or anything.
Yeah.
And he won't get fired for it. But the flip side, the flip side of that is, I really tend to care and want to care about the work that I do. I want it to be better all the time and more substantive and all of that. But there's no reward system at all. As a matter of fact, quite the contrary. I can't ever take as much care of a project as is really due in my way of thinking.
I just wanted to interject. When you say you can't take care of a project, what do you mean by a project? What is a project at your work?
Well, sometimes that's just one story.
Right?
But at other times, there have been sort of project stories that I've done. You know, an example might be like this Art at Home series that I did that was profiles of people with sort of talking about the art in their homes and how it mattered to them and, you know, what part of their lives it touched.
The bigger stories, the stories that have a more than one story in them.
Yeah. And, you know, they're just, there's, what am I trying to say? I kind of feel like I'm just whining about things right now, but I guess just to finish that thought, you know, I spent the longest period of my career in a more entrepreneurial mode, doing freelance work, and then later running a small business. And in those instances, you know, you get back what you put into it.
Yeah.
And I don't feel that in, you know, that's sort of a problem of the way that this company or my job in particular in general is structured.
Let me guess that that part of the frustration is that it seems like people who don't particularly perform very well and so forth still keep their jobs and still you know, collect the same salary. And whereas on the other hand, if you want to push yourself and achieve some excellence, it really requires, in other words, sacrifice on your part, because like you're talking about pursuing a bigger story, a project that is bigger than just a single story, really requires you just to knock yourself out all the further for no extra reward.
Yeah. I mean, and it's not just doing extra work on the story. It's also pushback of, you know, trying to find ways to keep my editors from loading more and more stuff on that would make it impossible for me to do that work or give work that focus. And, you know, I don't want this to sound like it's, you know, I think that this is, part of it is that, you know, it's part of the bargain working at a daily newspaper that you got to crank stuff out really fast. I mean, that's job number one. You know, as a good example of this, you know, today, this is a sort of extreme example, for Missoula, Montana, but today the jury came back with their verdict in this trial of the company W.R. Grace and three of its executives or former executives. It was the biggest environmental crimes case ever brought by the government, and happened to relate to events that happened up in Libby, Montana. So this case was actually being tried here in Missoula. And, you know, we got word that the verdict was coming out at 11:15. And, you know, basically we had to be poised and prepared to have a story on our website by 11:20. You know, I mean, that's the turnaround time at this point. Because if we didn't, we were going to get beat by the out-of-town newspapers. You know, the New York Times had theirs up pretty much around then. Because it was it's a big story. And so the New York Times was here, the AP, USA Today. Well, I don't know if all of those were actually here today, but they've been covering it regularly.
It sounds like a big story.
Yeah. And, you know, so getting back to what my point was, you know, I work for a company that is all about fast turnaround. That's, you know, fast turnaround of accurate stories. That's essentially the entire job description. But, you know, writing about the arts, I don't think that, you know, there's so little sort of hard news that happens in the art scene. And
yeah, I would,
more of what I do... What's that?
I would think why fast turnaround, accurate stories, that sounds great for parts of the paper, but the arts, I mean, why would that apply to the arts?
Because it's part of the newspaper.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, seriously, that's what it boils down to. A good example of how that plays out in terms of the logic of how these mines work is that there's an orchestra here in town called the String Orchestra of the Rockies. They perform they do like 4 or 5 concerts a year. And they only do one concert of each program. In other words, they're not repeating a program like a lot of orchestras do. They do that concert at 7:30 on a Sunday night. Well, because of the way that our paper is structured in terms of who's on shift when, it would be impossible to turn around a review of that concert for Monday's paper. Therefore, it doesn't get reviewed because Tuesday is too late. It's old news. Even though nobody else in the world would have reported it, it's still too late.
That is important.
So, yeah, it is. I mean, it really is because they've done, you know, they did a concert last weekend that I attended that was really fantastic and gave me some interesting things to think about.
Well, would it help if you pointed to other examples of, you know, how this stuff is covered in other cities?
No, not really. I've tried.
Okay, just checking.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
I occasionally read, you know, for example, articles in our local paper talking about, oh, the Louisiana Philharmonic Orchestra had a great concert a couple nights ago. It really doesn't seem to be on that pace.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that it's a case that's arguable, you know, but I'm finding that I think that part of this is a personal decision on the part of our editor. You know, the whole argument about whether reviews matter is still one that is not entirely settled at our paper, I would say. I mean, you know, I am expected pretty much at this point to do reviews of the Missoula Symphony whenever they do a concert. But
certain acts have a different policy, a different cachet.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think that their standard would be that we should be reviewing things that are attended by a lot of people and that sort of matter to the local cultural dialogue. Well, I think that's true. You know, the Missoula Symphony, when they do concerts, they do a pair of concerts over the course of a weekend, and they bring in, you know, between the two concerts, about 2,000 people. The String Orchestra of the Rockies doing one concert, they bring in about 350, 400 people. You know, so it's a smaller audience. It's a more refined group of people who are into it.
Sure.
Anyway.
But
so those are,
yeah. Clearly, you can't measure cultural significance just based on sheer numbers.
Yeah. But then, you know, today I had a story, and I knew that there was a story that I was going to do going into the day. Got there, started working on it, and, you know, felt like I was on a good pace to have sort of a reasonable day where I could actually, you know, one of the things that I need to do is go clean out my inbox because there's about 200 emails stacked up in there that weren't easily filed away or responded to immediately. And, you know, that reasonably takes more than just a day to clean out, but it'd be nice to at least make sure there's nothing that got overlooked that shouldn't have. So I kind of had that on my radar as something to work on, and I also needed to figure out what I was going to do next week. And one of my editors came to me and wanted me to cover this this Native American guy giving a lecture at a high school, which sort of has nothing to do with my beat, really, but, you know, such is life at a small-town paper where there isn't always somebody there to do those stories.
Right. Right. So you went to the school and listened to the guy talk, huh?
Yeah. And was there for about 2.5 hours and then took about an hour to write the story. So basically, you know, took up a full half of my day.
Sure. Sounds about right.
Yeah.
Well, I feel for you.
Yeah. I mean, I think that we could spend these entire conversations listening to me moan about things.
we could, but that wouldn't be a conversation. That would just be a mile long.
Exactly, and I feel like it.
Part of what makes this a conversation is that, for example, I would be curious to know. Okay, you write for a living,
mm-hmm.
you're writing all the time, and you're paid to write, which is great. So you've got lots of practice writing.
Mm-hmm.
Are you contemplating other writing projects then on the side that you know could eventually blow up into something bigger and take you away from all that newspaper stuff?
I would say yeah. I mean, I should also frame that by saying that ever since you first met me, whatever it was 20 years ago now. I had those plans, and not much has come of fruition from that. But
you are making
actually,
you have been making your living as a writer for how many years now?
Since I graduated, so since I was 21.
For your entire working life, you have been making your living as a writer. So it's but always somewhat, what do you call it, not following your most, not being your own boss. I don't know what is the disconnect exactly, although I know what it is, but I just don't know how to articulate it. I understand, I think, the dilemma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, there have been book projects. There was one that I was actually working on a proposal for some time, although I never got past the research stage. But I was really excited about it, and then I don't remember exactly what waylaid it, other than just having too many things on my plate. I know what it was. That was right about the time when we decided to build this house, and getting this house permitted and built was something that took a lot of time and effort.
Yeah, yeah. So that was not the narco tourism book.
No. that book was a great idea. That should be done by somebody else. because I just don't really think that I'm up for touring the world on drugs anymore.
No, but you could interview people who have, and you could still write.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's certainly true. There was a book that I was thinking about doing that would be sort of styled after those what were they called? Worst case scenario books. I don't know if you remember those.
Yeah, I remember those.
Fun little
there's
books
a number
that
of
actually
around here in New Orleans that were flooded.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
I had this idea to do a very straightforward and earnest book that would be a guide to urban ranching and hunting. So, you know, like looking into the real logistics of having a cow in your apartment, you know, what are the legal challenges involved in hunting squirrels or pigeons, and, you know, maybe have some recipes and things like that. And, you know, this seemed like a fun project that kind of combined some of my personal interests with my own particular, I guess, not necessarily my sense of humor, but a sense of humor that I appreciate, so perhaps I could produce it myself. And I actually did do a story for the newspaper a couple of years ago about urban hunting in Missoula and what the regulations are. And one of the most interesting things that I did discover, which surely would have made it into the book if I'd ever done it, was that, the problem with hunting in the city is that you run afoul of weapon laws. So, you know, you can't discharge a firearm in the city limits, for example.
I would I would think that'd be the problem.
That includes bows and this kind of thing. Except you can do this in a controlled and, I think, permitted shooting range. So if, for example, an elk were to accidentally wander into the indoor archery range over at the Archery Center of Montana, you could shoot it there if you had a license. Yes.
Or if it not so accidentally wandered in there.
Right, exactly. You know, what you could do is, like, get all your friends to herd it, you know, kind of, except that's sort of illegal. I think that's harassing wildlife or something.
Oh.
So not so much herd it as encourage it to go in there, you know, in a friendly way.
That's something to contemplate. Well, in these harsh economic times, I would think that topic might be more appealing than ever. And as I understand it, it seems to me like part of the whole game there in publishing books and stuff like that is getting the advance, getting some kind of advance, right? So, of course, if you have an article or two under your belt that you've actually written and published, I suppose, to show for it, couldn't hurt. So I would encourage that one. The of course, you'd have to interview Steve Bowen, who Tall Steve in Bloomington. You know, he's a council member, and they considered a chicken ordinance for the city of Bloomington.
Oh, yeah. Chicken ordinances are a huge thing. We had one here in Missoula as well.
Yeah, and anyway, he dressed up as a chicken in a giant chicken suit for the council meeting on that. And he's, you know, a sitting member of the Bloomington City Council. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
You know,
epitaph.
What's that?
That'll probably be on his epitaph.
Oh, yes. Yeah, exactly. Steve Volan. He wore a chicken suit.
Is that, I wouldn't doubt it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that that's a project that could happen and that I would be enthusiastic about. You know, the problem with those kinds of things, of course, is that you either need that big advance or you need a lot of time to work on it. And, you know, I could certainly pursue the big advance, but, you know, basically one of the limiting factors going on right now is that Dylan's in school, and so we don't have any income from her, and Julian is not yet a member of the working class, so we don't have any income from him.
Jay, all you need is that article that you wrote about it, a concept cover letter, and just some publishers to mail it off to.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
And then you could start collecting rejection letters or whatever. I mean, it really doesn't, at this point, require much time on your part. Just a little bit of time here and a little bit of time there. I would encourage you to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, well.
That's just me, though.
I should. Your point is well taken. I mean, you know, I did have a pretty sour experience with the first book proposal that I ever really put a bunch of effort into, because it was from an agent who had sold quite a number of very successful books, who actually suggested an idea to me to flesh out that he wanted me to, you know, turn into a proposal. And to make a very, very long story short, he just didn't seem to ultimately think that he could sell the book once I did all this work.
Yeah, that sucks. And,
yeah.
Of course, that is the question of, you know, the old, the question of the agent. Do you need an agent? Should you go down that road? And so forth. I would say at your particular stage and juncture in life, there's really no call to have an agent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just start fishing.
Yeah.
If anything comes up.
Yeah. So, the thing that I was about to say, just to finish that thought, is with dealing in school and all these expenses, I can't take that leap of just diving into something and you know, leaving my job. So, which
right,
is probably
right, no. But if you got a substantial advance, it would at least call the question.
Yeah, you know, my predecessor, actually, this is kind of an interesting thing that you may have, actually, you may know who I'm talking about when I say this. My predecessor in this job was a woman named Sherry Jones. She was the arts reporter at the Missoulian before I took the job, or was hired, rather. And she was in graduate school for creative writing at the time, and then produced, when she left the Missoulian, she sold a book that ultimately... I think she got a $100,000 advance from Random House, I believe it was. Could have my publishing house wrong on that. And the book was to be called, it was called the Jewel of Medina. You may have heard about this because Random House dropped it after it was turned into them.
Wow.
Not because, you know, at least they didn't say it was because of anything about the content of the book, but rather it was apparently because an Arabic studies professor in Texas read the book and wrote a long letter to the publisher saying that if they published this, it would cause riots in America and, you know, firebombings and people's lives would be at stake and this kind of thing, because this was a book about told from the experiences of Muhammad's wives, or one of his wives.
I'll be damned.
Yeah, so this was kind of, I mean, it was national news for quite a while. And then the publisher, the London-based publisher that ultimately published O.J. Simpson's If I Did It book, you know, after that thing got dropped and tossed around, they picked this book up and published it. Their offices in London were firebombed. What's, you know, the kind of irony at the end of all of this is that the book was just skewered by critics far and wide. because apparently, you know, I have to admit I haven't read it. It's nothing against her. I just I don't read a lot of novels these days. But everybody that I talked to who had read it said some variation of, yeah, it was just softcore porn. So.
Wow.
Or, you know, along the lines of like a what do they call those romance novels, you know?
Oh, my. Well, that is really something.
So there's a precedent in my position.
Yeah. I mean, okay, so the publishing offices in London were firebombed, but she's alive and well, right?
Yeah, I ran into her the other day. She's got her follow-up book is coming out next month, this month, I guess.
Okay, so she has charted the course, man.
Exactly.
You just need to emulate in some kind of way.
I don't really want to emulate her, though. She wears scarves, and I'm not into scarves.
Well, you think of it as emulating in some kind of reverse fashion. What's the reverse of a scarf? The absolute antithesis of a scarf.
A hairpiece?
Yeah, so you could wear hairpieces.
Yeah, or a jockstrap. A jockstrap, that's what I should do. Just walk around with a jockstrap on.
And nothing else. Okay. Well, now that we've discerned exactly what your future should be, I was thinking also we should talk about, just briefly here, as we wind down, about some potential future directions for this, for these conversations.
Yeah.
And I've been having, because I've enjoyed them a great deal, but they're somewhat, you know, hit or miss, I think, sometimes, in terms of whether or not we really feel like we're talking about anything or if we're just filling up time. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So
yeah, sure.
I was thinking there's a couple of things we might do to kind of make, to give a little structure, I guess you'd say. One is we could, one of us or both could be responsible in advance for kind of cooking up a general topic, something to talk
like
about.
Like water bags,
yeah, exactly like that. As a general theme, and you know, we could diverge from that and so forth, and take it very loosely. But we could do that and say, you know, in a week in advance, just to say what the topic is going to be, and kind of mull that over, and then actually talk about it. Another thing is also with TalkShoe, the TalkShoe, of course, is the platform we're using to record this. It is possible for other people to call and join in the conversation.
Oh, wow.
So I guess what I was saying is if anybody out there is actually listening to this conversation besides you and I and actually gets this far into it, 45, 50, 55 minutes, whatever we are now, is listen this far and think, after having heard all this foolishness that's come before, that they actually would like to call in and join the conversation at some point, that, you know, you should let us know. Because we
I think that would be dandy.
So, you know, I wouldn't want to just open it to the whole world, although the technology enables that.
You just did.
No. I mean, you could do it differently. So those are two ideas.
Yeah. We could invite hecklers.
Yeah, hecklers.
Yeah.
I probably have some relatives named Heckler.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Because you're Norwegian, right?
A little Norwegian, a little Czech, and a whole lot of German. But I've always found it's the Czech and the Norwegian that's more interesting to me.
Yeah. So they'd probably put an umlaut over the E.
The hecklers?
Or would it be like C-H-L-E-R?
You know, I don't think in Germany, I don't think they put umlauts over the E.
Oh, right, yeah. That's just in heavy metal music, isn't it?
Well, maybe. I'm trying to think. Certainly in Nordic countries, the umlauts only, you see them over the A's and the O's, but never over an E.
Right, yeah. U's get umlauts.
Yeah, that might be a U's. Yes, U's. Of course, the U. Yeah.
Right.
Well, umlauts, that could be, for example, a topic for future discussion.
Exactly, yeah.
I could probably have more to say about umlauts than you would imagine. But
I'm not actually surprised at all.
I don't know how to respond to that. This has been quite a pleasure. The nightcap that I fixed of the lemon liqueur and the absinthe seems to be giving me a splitting headache.
Nice. That
could be related to the Xanax or the bong hits or the vast quantity of Pinot Grigio that I was drinking earlier. So no. I really don't know what to chalk that up to.
Yeah, well, I would suggest, immersion in cold water.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, said you were doing shrooms, right?
Oh, right, I said that. Or somebody said that, yeah.
Somebody is doing shrooms right now.
Yeah. Somebody out. You know, it actually often gives me pleasure to think about the things that, you know, when I'm having a bad day or caught up in bullshit work, it always gives me pleasure to think that, you know, somewhere probably right in my city, maybe even within a couple blocks, somebody is having sex and having an orgasm right now. You know, and you know, everybody gets their turn, so maybe someday that'll be me. Thinking about, like, you know, somewhere out there, somebody is having shrooms and not thinking about work at all.
You're absolutely right. Even right now.
Yeah. Other people's pleasures. It's all that saves me. Should talk, maybe here in the future we could talk about this opera that I'm going to write with Matt. Because we didn't really get to that. No, we're actually working on a different project that I think is more realistic, because I don't think we have to pay for the rights to this one.
Ah, fantastic. Well, yeah, that does sound like an interesting conversation. We should probably wind this one down, though.
Exactly.
So, thanks for talking to me, Jay. I hope that we talk again soon, and until next time, cheers.
Yeah, same to you.
All right, bye-bye.
Later on. Bye-bye.
Well, the only problem is I'm not quite sure how to terminate the call. Hold on.
Okay. Are you there?